Peter Thomas Fornatal here. Before we get started today, just want to give a special word about our friends, our founding partner, the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. We started these shows just about a year ago, had no idea how things were going to go, and the very first partner slash sponsor we got involved with was the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. That means so much to me. The year's turned out great. It's been terrific. We've exceeded our own expectations in terms of how many people are listening. At the time, we didn't know how it was going to go. Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation believed in us. We believe in them. The TRF is always in need of support. If you like our show, if you like the fact that you don't have to pay for our show, you know, a lot of podcasts giving out gambling information would be behind a paywall at Patreon or something like that. That's not the way we want to roll. We want to give this show to you, the listeners, for free. And how we can do that is through sponsors and partners like the TRF. Take some time, if you will, and make a donation, trfinc.org/players. That's the best way to do it, so we get the credit. trfinc.org/players. You're listening to the In the Money Players Podcast. Hello and welcome to the In the Money Players Podcast. This is show number 98. It is Tuesday, December 17th. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornatal, back with you in the Brooklyn Bunker once again. Breaking format today, JK is off. In his absence, not one, but two special guests. We're going to start off with Eddie Olchek, author of a new book we'll talk all about. We're going to wrap things up with our final visit in 2019 with Kim Weir of the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. And without further ado, let's get to our first guest. And now I'm very happy to welcome back a very popular guest in podcast history. He was first on about a year ago, a little less, to talk about a big win. Actually, I lied. It was longer ago than that, because he was talking about his win in, I think it was the inaugural Pegasus handicapping contest. You've seen him on TV since then. You've heard him talk about racing. He's also got a new book we're going to be talking about. Eddie Olchek, welcome back to the In the Money airwaves.
Pete, how are you, man? Nice to be with you. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays.
Thank you so much. When was that you won the contest? It was 2 years ago, right?
Yeah, 2 years ago, the first year of the Pegasus. That is correct. Yeah, and it happened to be during my stage 3 colon cancer battle. When I got diagnosed on August the 4th at 7:07 p.m. in 2017, and ended up winning the tournament in late January of 2018. So, as I've said, and when we talked after that, that was the best medicine I had over the course of my battle with colon cancer, of coming from pretty much dead last, a lot like the same as Bruce did last year by winning the Stanley Cup, dead last going into the last race, and Gun Runner came up large for me, and somehow, some way, we found a way to get it done. So, yeah, it's hard to believe, we're coming up on 2 years since I won that tournament.
I haven't mentioned this to you before. At least I don't think I did. Maybe I forward you an email or something. But I've heard from several listeners who, as a result of hearing your story, went and got that colonoscopy scheduled.
Yeah.
And right. I know you're making a difference. And by continuing to talk about it, hopefully that's going to still be the case. How's your health, first of all? And are you still involved in trying to get other people to wake up and take this vital step that could save their lives?
Well, I appreciate that. And yes, I am feeling good. I just had my 3-month checkup about 10 days ago, and all clear and feeling good. And I got a big scan coming up in March. It'll be my 2-year post chemo treatments, and hopefully be cancer free again coming up in March of 2020. So there's always that, that apprehension, that unknown. I mean, cancer is always going to be with Eddie Olchek and my family, but all we can do is to continue to try to have positive thoughts and faith and prayers, and just keep doing what I'm doing. Get as far away as we can from what happened back in 2017. But, I do I'm hoping that people hear my story. Hopefully people will either look at it and say, I'm supposed to do this medically. I am going to follow through with it, or people can hear my story or hear anybody's story, you know, whether it's colon cancer or anything else, or just even making people aware that, hey, you know, if you don't feel good, it's okay to say something. Like if something is, doesn't feel right, it's okay to raise your hand. I don't care, man, woman, black, white, green, purple, where you're from. It's okay to know your body and to say, you know, geez, this doesn't feel right, or I need to go see somebody. And when it comes to a colonoscopy, I mean, since I got sick, the national recommended age has been lowered 5 years from 50 to 45. They're recommending that you get a colonoscopy when you're 45, not 50. So I would hope that people would pay attention to that. And look, if you're not going to pay attention to the medical recommendation, then hopefully if somebody hears my story, and I appreciate you having me on, Peter, but maybe I can scare them into getting it done. Because for me, I wake up one day and I can't go to the bathroom. I'm constipated, which was not normal for me. And next thing you know, 2 days later, I'm having a 6-hour surgery removing a tumor, or a mass, as they told me at that time, a mass the size of my fist, and removing 14 inches of my colon and telling me, 4 days later that I have stage 3 colon cancer. There's no family history in my family. Somehow I absorbed it. And I'm hoping that the so-called shitty weekend that you would have prepping for a colonoscopy, excuse my language, but look, I would rather have you have that day and go in and have the test, and the test is nothing, than going having to go through 6 months of hell of chemotherapy and fighting and battling for your life. So if I could scare somebody into getting it done and getting peace of mind, then it's well worth me telling my story. And also I talk vividly about that. You mentioned my book, but that's something that is a big part of my book that came out in October. And I'm hoping that if I can help one person either stay away from it, deal with it, or just help them get through the day, then it was well worth the 16 months of pen to paper to write the book.
Well, you've helped a lot more than one person that we know about just from this very show and that previous appearance. And just to piggyback on to what you're saying, with sure. This type of thing, the earlier you can detect it, the much better yes. chance you're going to have. So even if you're not feeling anything, I recommend going by those guidelines. And, you know, we know yeah. the demographics of our audience. We do have plenty of young people, but we also have a lot of people between 40 and 50. And I'll just underline yeah. that.
Well,
idea.
Look, it's a great point. And I think it's important to emphasize that is, look, obviously the you know, the medical people, the medical, numbers and information and the stats tell us that colon cancer is on the rise, and for them to lower the recommended age for a colonoscopy from 50 to 45 tells us one thing. The numbers are way up. Cancer does not discriminate. So you need to be proactive. And like I said, you want to be ahead of this, and you need to pound the door of your doctor, your physician. I don't care if you have a family history or not. Look, I'm telling you right now, there is no family history of cancer in the family of Eddie Olczyk. And all of a sudden, like I said, one day I couldn't go to the bathroom, and here I am having colon cancer. So it can happen to anybody. And I want people to be aggressive, to know their body. And like I said, it could be anything. And I've heard stories from many, many people and been reached out to, and people just saying, you know, gosh, I had this pain in my chest, and I kind of put it off, and I read your book, and, you know, you told me it's okay to, you know, raise your hand and say, geez, you know, I don't feel good. I need to go somebody, you know, to go and see a doctor. And, you know, a gentleman, you know, was on the verge of having a massive heart attack if he didn't go in and see a doctor. He felt this pain in his chest, and he felt inspired by my book to go seek help. And, you know, look, that's my goal when people hear my story, and it could be anything outside, it could be cancer, it could be anything, is that, you know, we as a society, and look, us as guys, we want to put things off and it's not going to happen to us. And so if I can be an example to anybody, is to just say, hey, you know what, I'm going to heed that advice and I'm going to go see somebody and help myself. Because if you don't help yourself, you know, you're never going to know. But the numbers tell us with colon cancer is, unfortunately, it's way up. And that's why the average age, the recommended age has come down. And we need to be very proactive in society, both men and women. And hopefully we can save people from having to go through what I did and all the other millions of people that have had to go through the battle of colon cancer.
The book is called Eddie Olczyk, Beating the Odds in Hockey and in Life. Obviously, your illness and wanting to get this word out there was part of the motivation for wanting to put pen to paper and get this story and your story out there. But I assume there was more to it than just wanting to serve the public by getting the word out there. What inspired you to tell this story?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot there, Pete, but I think first off for me is I've had the opportunity of writing a book prior, and you know, I mean, I've lived an incredible life. I mean, you know, whether it was, you know, playing for my hometown team, the Chicago Blackhawks, being drafted in the first round as a 18-year-old kid, you know, which had never been accomplished before, for an American-born hockey player to be the first American-born native son that be ever drafted by his hometown team is certainly something very proud of. And look, there was a lot of pressure of playing in my hometown. I mean, I got selected to 1984 U.S. Olympic hockey team as a 16-year-old and played in the Olympics as 17. And, you know, I mean, just my life journeys in hockey and obviously horse racing being such a huge part and passion of my life since I was, you know, 12 or 13 years old. So I've always had the stories of hockey and horse racing, pucks and ponies, and I kind of got cold feet. My co-author, Perry Lefko, is an award-winning writer and book author and a huge horse racing guy, who, that's how my path came across Perry, was back in the late 80s when he was living in Toronto doing horse racing for the Toronto Sun and freelancing and writing. And I was playing for the Maple Leafs, and, you know, him being a hockey and me being a hockey guy, it just kind of was a match made in heaven. And, you know, Perry had talked to me about, you know, 7-8 years ago, and we started doing some talk and dialogue, and then got a little bit of cold feet, and I'm like, nobody wants to hear my story. And I just got cold feet, Pete. And no, that was it. I just didn't, my heart wasn't in it. And then, believe it or not, no pun intended, is when I got sick and diagnosed with stage 3 colon cancer in August of 17. During my treatment and my battle, I thought, you know what, maybe there's a story here. Maybe there's an opportunity here to tell a few hockey stories, tell a few horse racing stories, but really kind of tying it in, like I said, no pun intended, that this was the final chapter on the decision to write the book. It was me getting sick and hopefully helping people out there and bringing attention to this horrible disease, and to just be completely transparent and honest and let people know what I went through. And, you know, that, you know, going through the chemo treatments, there was a time when I wanted to quit after treatment too. It broke me down. I mean, my side effects were, brought me to my knees, and I have never quit at anything in my life. I never quit at courting my wife of 31 years, or, you know, going through marriage, you know, battles, or raising kids, or being a hockey player, being down 5 or 6 goals as a coach or a player, or being down $25 at the racetrack. All right, scratch that, $2,500 at the racetrack. I mean, I was never going to bail. I was never going to quit. And when I was in treatment 2 of my chemotherapy, which I got every other week for 6 months for 48 hours, my side effects just broke me down. I would have nosebleeds and neuropathy and bad headaches, and I would just go to the bathroom. Like, I had no control of my bowel movements at all. I would just go to the bathroom, and I'm like, how in the hell am I going to get through today, let alone get through 10 more treatments? And I told my wife, I quit. I'm done. I can't live like this. Like, how am I going to get to tomorrow, where I just can't, it's overcome me, and it's just taken over everything. And my wife just grabbed me and pretty much gave me the greatest pep talk I've ever had in my life. And she just looked at me and she just said, look, you got to fight. You got to fight for me. You got to fight for our kids. And you got to fight for all the people that love you. And we had a moment, Pete, that lasted probably 30 minutes, and all I did was cry, and my wife hugged me, and I just, you know, look, it was hard. And I said, look, okay, so I got back my hockey hat mentality and my passion in horse racing. Was like, okay, I'm down, but I'm not out. And I'm going to just go day to day, and I'm just going to take this thing head on. And but I talk about that in the book. It's normal. Like, you feel alone. You feel, you know, you have enough quiet time to last you a lifetime when you're in the middle of this battle. And like I said, I was on the verge of breaking, but I needed that from my wife and the caretakers and caregivers, in particular, my wife and my family and my friends that were there every step of the way, helped me get through. And we have to make sure that we're looking out after them, because my wife, Diana, I mean, I never saw her weak. I never saw her down. I never saw her worried around me. But I know when I would be in our basement for 16 or 17 hours a day, and my wife was upstairs tending to our kids or our two pups, our dogs, our two sister labs, I'm sure she let her guard down and was wondering what was going to happen to me. So we need to make sure we're looking out after not only the people that are sick, but also the caretakers and caregivers. And, you know, we got to make sure that we're checking in on them too, to make sure, because they're going through a lot as well. I mean, they're going through a psychological battle like you wouldn't believe. So, you know, I just think that, you know, for me, having gone through it and now being on the right side of it, is that was, to me, the goal of putting pen to paper with Perry for 16 months. And like I said, if I can reach somebody and help them get through the day, or help them believe, or say, hey, if that old broken down hockey player and horse player can do it, well, you know what, I can do it too. And I would say this, is that I'm hoping three things get accomplished if somebody reads my book, Peter. And one is that I bring them hope. And two, I hope that they laugh a little. And three, I hope they love a little bit more. Because when I was going through my battle, and if I could accomplish two of those three things, then it was well worth me putting my heart and my soul and all my feelings into this book. But the one thing that helped me get through my battle was I was very much at peace when I was going through this battle. And what I mean by that was, even though I was scared and I was broken down and worried, I was very much at peace, because the most important people in my life have always known how I felt about them. And I've always told my wife and my kids and my family and the people that are, we all have a circle. But those people in my circle, you know, I've always said to them, and I don't know where I learned this, but I've always told them, look, like, God forbid if something would happen to me, I want you to know how much you have meant to me and that you have made my life. And I am lucky that, you know, that we have had our, you know, our time together. And I've always told them how much I loved them. And I learned that from my mom and dad, who are still with us. And you know, my wife would always tell me, nothing's going to happen. Don't talk like that. And I get it, but no pun intended again, but like, it would kill me that if I wasn't here, that the most important people in my life did not know how I felt about them. And going through that battle, Pete, it helped me get through. I was at peace because, look, if when they told me I was sick and they said in 6 months, we're going to reassess and then go from there. If my time was up, at least I was at peace and knew that the most important people in my life knew how I felt about them. And that helped me get through. And that's what I meant. That's what I mean by hopefully people love a little bit more after reading the book, and hopefully they will grab the people that are most important to them and let them know, because look, we're all day to day in the big picture, you know, like we are. I mean, you never know what's ahead. And for me, I was very lucky to have learned that and been able to express that to the most important people in my life. And I'm very blessed. And I had a lot of time to reflect on my life. And I think people always ask me now, Pete, is like, do you look at things differently now than you did before you were sick? And I really don't. I mean, besides the petty things of, you know, getting cut off in traffic or you know, being, you know, running late or, you know, whatever, just little things that really at the end of the day, I mean, it's nothing. But I think the one thing I reflected on, and like I said, I had enough quiet time to last me a lifetime when I was going through my treatment, is I am more proud now of what I was able to accomplish as a hockey player, as somebody in the community, a so-called public figure, somebody in the game of horse racing. I'm more proud of what I accomplished now than I was prior to when I was sick. Because like I said, I had enough time to reflect and to see what I've been able to accomplish, but which trumps everything is being a husband, being a father of four kids. That is my greatest achievement in life. And that helps me get through every day. And hopefully somebody can be inspired by knowing my story, being on with you, or reading my book, or just maybe, you know, talking about what I've been able to overcome and endure and be able to conquer. And hopefully that is the case.
I love so much of what you're saying. There's so many great points. You answered a couple of questions I had on the list here. And one of them in particular, I wanted to just loop back to. I thought the naming of the last chapter of the book I was going to ask you about. It's Thank God I Got Sick. And I think from that answer, we can see why. You feel like you're really fulfilling a purpose, not just helping people in a preventative medicine way, but helping people think about their lives in a better way. I mean, hockey players, horse players, a lot of us, we're not necessarily known for being the most in touch with our feelings and being able to share these things. I think of you as a tough guy. I've been watching, not much older than me, but somebody, because you started so young, I've been watching play since I was so young. And to get that lesson about sharing feelings with the people you love, something, and I mean this as an absolute compliment, just to be clear, but something I associate a little more getting from Mr. Rogers than from any old
Jack. Yeah, for sure.
And it's very, I love
it. A great movie, by the way. Tom Hanks did an amazing job. I would highly recommend it. I'm not a movie guru by any stretch. I mean, look at, I'm a Let It Ride, slap shot type of guy movie. I mean, and also the Hurricane Carter. That's another, that's probably my favorite movie of all time. But I appreciate that, Pete. And look, like I said, me as a young kid, I was always a bigger kid. And I was as I got older in my teenage years, I had a coach say publicly, Eddie Olczyk has a chance to make it to the NHL. But he might eat his way out of the NHL. And my response to that is, well, first off, what's wrong with a hungry hockey player? And two, you look at that, somebody making fun of somebody's weight or how they look in society and say that publicly. If you said that today, if I would say that on television today, there's a pretty good chance that I would not be on television tomorrow. So it is a form of bullying. It is a form of harassment, and I had to overcome those things as a young player and as a young person, not a player, but a person. And, at that time in the society that we lived in, it's somebody's opinion and that's fine. But, but in today, the society has changed and we're much more sensitive and we're much more so-called PC and I get all that, but I just always learned to put my heart on my sleeve, and I've always been a very emotional person. And there's a kind of an inside joke here with my friends and family is I'm very sensitive, and it's one thing that my wife was attracted to me was as I was a very sensitive person when we first came together, and I'm not ashamed of that. I'm not embarrassed to say that. It's just kind of who I am. And to be able to have that courage and to come out and to say that. And I've always been that way. And I'll say this, is I think I learned that affection is probably the best word is from my dad. Because anytime that I saw my dad embrace his late father and my grandfather, my grandfather was born in Poland. He moved to Germany. My dad was born in Germany. And then my dad came over in the boat when he was 7 years old, and anytime my dad would see his father, he would always look him in the eye, shake his hand, and he always would embrace him with a hug or a kiss on the cheek. And that stood with me forever. And I always did that with my dad, who, you know, gave me every opportunity that I've been presented. And I remember when I was like, I think 12 or 13 feet, we were in a hockey rink. I was played a game. I came out. There were all kinds of kids around me, my teammates. There were people around. My dad walked in, you know, he's walking in, and I came out of the locker room with my hockey gear. And for some reason, and it's the only time it ever happened, for some reason, I had not embraced my dad the way that I had prior to that. I didn't shake his hand. I think I shook his hand, but I didn't give him a kiss or I didn't give him a hug. After, you know, like I said, it was the first time I had seen him. And I didn't think anything of it. The only thing I thought of, well, geez, you know, there's a lot of people here and, you know, what are these kids going to think? Or, you know, it was just one of those moments where I just was like, I don't say I was embarrassed, but I didn't know how to react. And like I said, I was 12 or 13. I can remember it. I was at the Randhurst Ice Arena in the suburbs of Chicago in Mount Prospect. And my dad was mad at me for a week. Like you can just tell when your dad's pissed off at you, right? And I couldn't figure out why. Like, I couldn't figure it. And then after that, I saw him. I shook his hand. I gave him a kiss. I hugged him every day. And then one day, I think we were on our way to the rink or whatever, and I just said, "My dad, are you mad at me?" And my dad just kind of paused, and he just said, "You remember last Saturday at the Randhurst Ice Arena when all those people were around and you didn't shake my hands or give me a kiss?" And that stuck with me the rest of my life, and I still embrace my dad. I mean, that was the only time that I didn't do it, you know? And my dad, it wasn't on purpose, but I think maybe that's where I've gotten to become, and I'm very proud of that because my dad's the hardest working guy that I've ever known or met, and he was in a grocery store business for 55 years, and I think that's just kind of where maybe I learned that, and I've always let the people know how I felt about him in my life, and I'm very thankful for that, and I'm very proud of that, and hopefully, like I said, hopefully you'll love a little bit more after reading the book, and because you know what, the society we live in now, we could certainly use, you know, a little bit more of that. And look, I'm not one to stand up on any pedestal or preach or anything like that. I'm just saying this is how I chose and live my life. And hopefully I can make a difference in somebody's by knowing how I've chosen to live.
The idea that you can be masculine and still take care of yourself and tell people you love them, it's just going to lead to a more healthy approach to life in general. And I'm very glad you've shared it with us on the show and very glad you've shared it in the book. We'll remind people again, the book, Eddie Olczyk, Beating the Odds in Hockey and in Life. I haven't read the whole thing. I'll be honest. I've paged through. We set this up last minute. I wanted to get this out there so people could order before the holidays, but I don't know the answer to this next question. How much racing made its way into the book?
Anytime you could get odds in the title of a book, you're damn right it's going to be a lot about horse racing. Anybody that knows me or maybe just knows of me, whether it's from, you know, being on your show or being on the NBC horse racing team or, you know, winning some of the tournaments I've been able to do, my passion is horse racing and handicapping. It always has been. Since I was a 12-year-old kid, I went to the racetrack. Sadly, the gentleman that introduced me to horse racing, Mr. Tony Quillis, he was a hockey manager of a handful of teams that I grew up playing on here in the suburbs of Chicago. He recently passed away, and he was the one that brought me to the track as a 12-year-old kid at the old Arlington racetrack. His son Danny and his buddy JJ were big horse players, and we went to the racetrack when I think I was 12 or 13 and, I maybe had $8 or $10 in my pocket. And, just seeing those pristine animals, 1,200 pounds going 30 miles an hour up and down Arlington's turf course and dirt track and hearing Phil Georgeff in the background, I was hooked from day one. And, I make a couple of bets that day and, you're losing and all of a sudden, you hit a you hit a quinella for, you know, for like $54 or whatever it is, and you got it a couple of times. And you know, look at, I'm 12 years old, and I go up to the window, and you know, I hand the ticket taker my winnings, you know, and he goes, "Hey, how old are you?" I go, "Hey," he didn't ask me how old I was when I lost the last three races. So, I mean, what the hell's going on here, you know? And the guy winked at me. He gave me back 108 or 118 bucks, and I gave him $2, and you know, hey, thanks for the effort, you know. And the guy thought it was like the greatest thing in the world. Look, I probably looked like I was 16 or 17 when I was 12, just to be honest. But since that day, I've been hooked. And I mentioned Mr. Quillis, the gentleman that introduced me to horse racing. It was back in late October. I went and visited him at the house, and he'd been battling cancer the last 3 years. And he wanted one last winner. And I was on my way to the Breeders' Cup, and I said, "Mr. Quill, my best bet is Vino Rosso." I said, "Whatever you got, I want this to be a winner." And I'm proud to say that I was able to give the gentleman that brought me into this game, I was able to give him one last winner before he passed away here in the last couple of weeks. And being at a service and being hearing the story that he won his last bet because of me, certainly a very emotional time. And a gentleman that meant a lot to me in hockey and horse racing, and it meant a lot. And my life has been around hockey, is about family, and a lot of stories about horse racing. And I give him credit for the primary assist, Pete. I give him the primary assist in my book for introducing me to this great game. So yeah, there's lots of tough beats. There's lots of great wins, backdoor wins. None better than Maximum Security, rightfully so, getting disqualified in my opinion at the Kentucky Derby and getting Code of Honor bumped up and backdooring the Superfecta that day. So,
oh my goodness.
But yeah, there's plenty of stories about horse racing and the people that, you know, I've had to earn the respect of to get into this game and in working for NBC, and very thankful and telling the story how I got the job at NBC, of getting on the horse racing team and my introduction on NBC on national television, my first two races of picking horses for NBC on national television. So there's a lot there, but absolutely 100%. This, I would not have written this book if horse racing was not allowed to be a part of it. I can promise you that. And not only the gambling part, but also the ownership part. I think some real interesting stories as well. So yes, Pete, long-winded. There's a lot in there about horse racing, and hopefully people out there will enjoy the read and learn a little bit more about me as a horse racing guy and as a hockey guy and just somebody in the community.
That Vino Rosso story is fantastic, and just one of those wins that's worth something more than money that all horse players, I think, have had at some point. You've had so many memorable winning days. You've touched on a few of them already in this show. But if I were to hold your feet to the fire and ask you for your most memorable day at the track in your life, what comes to mind first?
Let's see. 2009, June the 19th, Hollywood Park, pick 6, Jerry Holzer. Oh my gosh, the cliff notes of this was I was actually traveling home from Las Vegas from the NHL Awards the day before on June the 18th of 2009. And I was traveling home on the Friday. The day before, I blew the pick 6. There was a horse in there with a first-time gelding that I like to play, an angle I like to play with a horse that has shown some talent. For whatever reason, I decided to throw that horse out. And lo and behold, what ended up happening, the gelding ended up winning, and I blew the pick 6. So I was traveling home the next day on that 19th of June, and I was handicapping at the airport. And, of course, Friday night racing at Hollywood Park, you know, it's not starting until, you know, whatever, 9 Chicago time, whatever it was. So I'm handicapping. All of a sudden, our flight is late. Our flight is running late. And again, at that time, you know, I thought I had plenty of time. I was going to land at like 7:30 Chicago time. And, you know, I'll make the races. I'll be able to call in on my ExpressBet account, and the rest is history. So now we're really getting late, and I'm handicapping on the plane. So, you know, what do I do? I get on my phone. We land at like 9:15 or 9:20, like, you know, an hour before I'm supposed to have the pick six bet in. And I place a $168 wager on the pick six. And lo and behold, I get home. First couple of races are taped. They're taped on the old VCR, and I see the third leg live. I win. I go back and watch the first two legs win. The favorite wins the first, 9-2 wins the second, and like a 9-2 wins the third. And I'm watching the race, and I go, you know what? I'm feeling pretty good about, you know, where we're going and how this is all kind of materializing here. And sure enough, I get to the last leg, and I have 8 of the 12 horses in the last race. And sure enough, Daryl Vienna, Martin Pedroza comes in with I think Suances de España at 5-1, and the payout for $168 investment ended up being $500,000 on a $168 investment. And I do have to give credit to Neil French, because in race 5, I singled a 17-1 shot and a horse by the name of Streets of Heaven that got me through. And Alonzo Quinonez was the jockey, and it was one of those where an angle that I absolutely love, if you don't mind, is that
please,
this was a horse that had run 7 days prior, and it had been off almost, yeah, I guess just over a year, if I can remember. And the horse ran on June the 12th, and it was a speed and fade, but this horse did not want to run close to the lead. So I just thought that Neil French was like, okay, you know what? This horse needs to run. I'm going to give him a race. I'm going to show speed and fade. And then I'm going to take him off the pace. And I think that race was 7 furlongs or 6.5 at Hollywood Park that day. And sure enough, they take this horse off the pace and goes off. I think actually goes off at 20-1. And I singled that horse, and the rest is history. So a day I will never forget for Cashin for over a half a mil. And as I told everybody, it got me even, Pete. It got me even, which was the greatest score of all. So, yeah, that's something that I'll never forget. Yeah, so for $168, I got a half a schmill. So that was pretty good. And I had 5 or 6, you know, whatever, 7 times. Because I had, you know, I had 8 of 11 in the last race. And that was like $3,300 for 5 of 6. And there were only 3 winners. The pool was like $1 million. I think the pool was like $1.9 million total. And actually, in the last race there, when I said I had 8-11, when they were turning for home, I actually, like, 3 of my 8 horses were for the whole pool, and they were sitting like 4th, 5th, and, you know, 6th, and they looked like they were running. You know, so it was like, holy! Played in LA with the Kings back in 06, and spent a few days, or a few months at Hollywood Park when I was playing out there. But and also, anytime I go out, I mean, I feel sick in my stomach. It's not there anymore. But also, a smile comes to my face and go, you know what? Had a pretty good damn day there once back in 2009.
Complex emotions, no doubt. As a bettor, what are your primary goals? Are you looking for entertainment? Are you trying to make money? How would you describe your goals and your general approach to wagering?
Well, I mean, I think it's a combination of both. I mean, I think that, you know, there are days, like, I mean, there probably isn't a day, full disclosure, that I don't pick up the form and just look at the races and And just, you know, like I said, just kind of get a feel of, you know, maybe how a track is playing, or, you know, there's certain tracks I know that I seem to have success at, or at least I have a feel for. I mean, look, you know what it's like. You can have a feel for a track, and sometimes, you know, you could have a one horse race and still lose. Like, that, it's just, that's how it is. And I'm okay with that. But, you know, I think my handicapping philosophy has changed a lot. I think it has evolved, which is probably the best word to describe it. I was not a believer in track bias 10 years ago. But over time, I've become much more aware. I use that as a handicapping tool, because I do believe there are days where you're not going to be able to win on the lead. Like, you're just not. And I think when you can find, and vice versa, there's days that you're not going to be able to win off the pace. And that is both grass and dirt and synthetic and slot and whatever it is. So I think I've used that much more. I've always been a big turn back guy. I enjoy turf racing a lot, but, you know, I just think that the times where I've been able to, you know, have some separation is, you know, you have to do your homework, you have to do your study. You know, I am a big believer in video, and everybody has access to video now, where maybe in the old days, just say even 15 years ago, Pete, like, really, you know, the access to getting the races was obviously much more difficult then than it was now. So if you were to look, I have enough VCR and VHS tapes here with old races of taping races, of going back and just looking at trips and seeing how, you know, how jockeys handled horses or whatever. But now it's obviously much easier. And look, I follow and I watch whether I have action in a race or not. I'm always looking for a horse that, you know, the obvious ones are the ones where I don't go all in as much as maybe some other people, because everybody sees it. Like, I try to find the ones where it is hard to find, to look at where maybe a jock is not moving his arms, or maybe a jock is in behind horses for a schooling, or just a tough trip in general where a horse never was able, you know, to really run, or a jock takes a horse back instead of getting him close to the lead. So, for me, I know there's a lot there, but I've learned the hard way. You know, I go stretches as well where, like I said, I couldn't pick a one horse race. And then all of a sudden you gain a little bit of confidence and, you know, you just see it and you hit it out of the park. And, you know, as my buddy, my best friend, Dominic, who is a horse player as well. And he's very much, you know, prevalent in the book as well, is, you know, you never have enough on the winners, and you always have too much on the losers. But for me, it's a passion. I love it. Yeah, I'm in it to make money, but also it is entertainment for me. And I know my limits. I know where, okay, you know, today that's it. I'm done. I'm gonna fold the tent but I'm still the guy that, you know, if I'm busy or I have a game or a family event, I'm not afraid to go ahead and make my bets early, and then you know, put the old DVR on and then tape the races and come back and watch them and make sure that nobody calls me or texts me, or I don't look at the results and get some entertainment 4, 5, 6 hours later. And that's just my love for the game.
And that's something I think a lot of listeners who are busy like yourself with other lives and careers, a way to continue to enjoy the sport and get that visceral excitement out of the sport. That's something I could see them copying. You mentioned the turnback angle. That's one we've talked about on these shows before, but not in a while. Yeah. I'm curious how you use them. I mean, is it as simple as any time a horse is cutting back in distance, you're going to move them up a little bit, or is there a specific way you try to use turnbacks to your advantage in your handicapping?
I think it's a great question, and there's a lot there, but I look at it, it's going to get my attention for sure, regardless of how the horse ran the last race or not. Now, I like to see style of how the horse runs, Pete. I'd like to see, okay, well, how, you know, at least in my opinion, how does this horse like to run? Does he want to be in the mid pack? Does he want to come from out of it? You know, all those things kind of play into it. So for me, I'm I am a big believer is that, you know, the horse does have some bottom, especially my pal Matty Carruthers over there at TVG.
Oh, sure.
Does an amazing job. He's a believer of that aspect, especially at the lower levels where, you know, you get some horses that have some foundation, especially the maidens, the maiden 12s or the 16s or whatever they are. I'm not adverse to betting, you know, maiden 10s or straight maidens. If there's an opportunity to make a score or if I think a horse has a chance, I'm going to bet him. And you got to take what the track gives you. You know, you might say, look, I'm not going anywhere lower than 4-1 or 5-1, but look, sometimes they give you 2-1 and that's a hell of a number to take. But I do look at how the horse wants to run. And I think for a lot of the ones, and I mentioned Streets of Heaven, you know, the Neil French horse back in 2009 that helped me hit the pick six, you know, he was a horse that I thought wanted to run off the pace. He looked more comfortable of making one run. And I thought, wow, this race 7 days before he showed speed and stopped. I'm like, well, man, that's not how this horse wants to run. I think this horse wants to be taken back. So I think you can use that angle in certain situations. But again, how is the turf course playing? Is it front or the dirt? Is it horses coming from behind? What are the other horses in the races doing? So you play that all in, you take your notes, you put it in the blender and you sit there and go, okay, you know, what am I willing to take on this horse? Or am I playing pick threes, pick fours, daily doubles, exactas? Do I think this horse has a chance? So there's a lot there, but I do look at the speed and fade and you know, how does the horse want to run in a particular race and will it suit his style? And I think that's what's so awesome about our game is to be able to decipher that. And look, I'm not a sheets guy. I know a lot of my friends are. I mean, Joel Quinville, the outstanding coach of the Florida Panthers, a three-time head coach Stanley Cup winner with the Chicago Blackhawks. He's a huge sheets player. He's a huge horse guy. I mean, I respect Joel very much. He's a huge guy that, you know, goes by the numbers. And I know there are a lot of people that do. And I just never have learned it. I think I've been intimidated by it to a certain extent. I will take their, you know, information and digest it. But, you know, I am as, and I'm proud to say this, I'm as old school as you can get. I get the form. I get the pen and the markers out and I go to the computer, you know, a little more new school, to look at the replays and try to figure some things out. But I think I'll do that for, I don't think there's any doubt that'll be the way that I have success or not. Well, it would be the rest of my life as being a little bit old school with a little bit of new age and getting the computer involved as well.
What do you think is more important, to be a better handicapper or to be a better bettor?
To me, I don't think there's any doubt that if you can manage your finance and manage your bankroll, you will make more money that way than you will from your handicapping. That there's no doubt because look, you can handicap. A lot of guys that I know, and look, and we all go through it, and I'm right at the top of this list. You're going to go into cold spell. You're going to be all around it, and you're just going to zig when you should zag. And I always tell newbies or I tell buddies that have played the horses like I have for 39 years, sometimes it's okay to bet win plays. Like sometimes it's okay. Like, and just to gain traction, to gain confidence, like there's nothing worse than picking out a 7-7 or an 8-1 shot. Perfect example was for me, the last race on Sunday at Gulfstream. I want to say the horse name was Def Leonard, a turf horse. It was the 8 horse. I zero it in on this horse. I tried to get really cute in the pick fours and in the doubles, in the tries, because I knew this horse was going to be at least 10 or 12-1. That's what my number was. And I'm like, you know what? Okay. So I bet 50 and 50 on a big deal. But then I invested, 500 or 600 in gimmicks. And what happens? I think it was Def Leppard. Don't quote me. I thought that was the name of the horse in the last at Gulfstream on Sunday. He ends up winning. He goes in the gate. He's 8-1. He goes off at 7-1, and he wins. So, I get a little bit of a double. I hit the pick four once. But that was an opportunity where you just sit there and go, you know what, you dummy? Like, you should have taken your $850 investment and just said, look, what's wrong with, again, I get it. What's wrong with 7 or 8-1 at 400 and 400? But I thought, well, geez, this could really make the exotics pay. So, it's just that aspect of it is where I handicapped really well, but I didn't bet it the right way. So look, even though I'm experienced and, you just sometimes you got to look at it and you got to figure out, okay, well, what is best here at this particular time? And, you live and learn. But I think if you can manage your money and you can learn the handicapping skill and you can, tie it in, you're going to make a lot more money if you can manage your money and handicap than you are if you can handicap and manage your money in that order. Because I just think that there are too many times you miss opportunities. And again, you asked me earlier, Pete, your goals in handicapping, like, what is it? Like, some guys don't want to bet 400 and 400 or four and four, $4 and $4 on a horse that's 7-1. They'd rather invest that 800 or that $8 in a gimmick or in an exotic or whatever it might be. So I get it. I'm fine with that. But I would say to anybody, look, if you like a horse, and I would probably say anything north of 8-1, in my opinion, if you like a horse that's 8-1, you got to bet him win in place. You got to. You just don't try to hit the whole – don't try to hit the whole, the whole grand slam. Like, you just bet a couple of bucks on that. The worst-case scenario, you get even. You get your money back because you're going to be – look, and I've lived it. Trust me. I'm as dumb as anybody. Like, you don't bet a dime on this horse and the thing comes back paying $20 and $11 in the place position and you invested, $200 or $300 in daily doubles and pick fours, at least you get your money back. And at the end of the day, look, if I could be even every day, I'd be a happy human. And that's kind of the great question, but I would say learn to manage your money first. And then apply your handicapping skill second.
Which pools are you the most active in? And we'll include contests as an option. It sounds like you put your money in a lot of different places. I'm curious to get a little bit of an overview of that.
Yeah. I mean, I try to play in contests, but it always seems that my real world gets in the way of horse racing sometimes. So, if you're going to play in tournaments, and look, I played in a tournament on Express Bet last week, the race with Spun the Run in Maximum Security in New York. That was a part of the tournament, and I had a book signing that day, and I made my bets early, and it was just one of those days where I tried to do it half-assed, to be honest with you, and I'm just saying, look, it cost me the tournament because I ended up in fourth place, and I was signing books at Barnes & Noble in the suburbs of Chicago for 2 hours during the tournament. And I made my bets early, and I made a bet when I had a pit stop during the book signing. And, I blew the tournament. There's no doubt in my mind I win the tournament if I'm not doing what I'm doing. But, I'd like to play in tournaments. I want to play in more of them, but just it's not conducive in my life right now. But, I'm a pick five guy. I will say this, if I can, and I do stuff for ExpressBet and the Stronic Group. They have been great to me. Belinda and Mr. Stronic have been absolutely incredible to me, and I'm proud to be a part of their family. I don't think there's any question in my mind, without a doubt, the best bet in horse racing today is the Stronic 5. If you look at the payout of this bet, and look at the low takeout is incredible, and certainly that helps that. But my point is, any horse player out there, if you just do a history check on the Stronic 5, just take the last 15 times they've run the Stronic 5.
and you look at the payouts, just look at the payouts first of the individual races, and then go look out at the payout of what it paid, do yourself a favor. Look at the payouts for the individual races of the Stronach 5, and then put pen to paper. Remember, it's a dollar gimmick, which I think is huge, huge. Yeah. If you go and just put a pen to paper and go, okay, I see a $20 horse, a $14 horse, and then 8, 8, 9. And you sit there and go, well, geez, that's, I mean, look, you got three pretty chalky horses. You got a 9-1, and then you got a 7-1. You go, yeah, pick five, a dollar, I don't know, maybe 5,000, maybe 6,000. Last week, Stronach 5, those were the payouts. The thing paid $19,000 for a dollar. So, to me, my money goes to the Stronach 5. I love pick fours. I'll play pick sixes, the old traditional. I will get roped into the rainbow every once in a while. My suggestion would be, and this is just, again, I'm not getting up here and on the pulpit. Even if they would raise those rainbows to 50 cents, or you want to get exotic and make it, you know, 80 cents or 60, whatever, a mandatory 50 cents or 60 cents, I think you would have a much better opportunity to hit the whole thing, because I think it eliminates a lot of the people or a lot of the players that go in there and go, single, all, single, single, all, or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, I just think if you made it a little bit more, you look at, I think the goal of that, yeah, is for a 20 cent player to be able to hit it and cash in for 3 or 4 million. But I don't think that, you know, look at, it's happened. I get it. But I just get a feeling is that I think you get for a handicapper, a die-harder, I think that you get a truer opportunity to be able to hit for the whole thing if you raise the denomination up just a little bit, because then I think it forces you to make decisions instead of hitting the all button, which is easy. Look, like I said, I hit the all button. I'm full disclosure, for sure. If I like a 30-1 shot in one of those races at Gulfstream, if I'm singling that horse, you're damn right I'm going to hit the all button a couple of times, and I'm going to invest, you know, $250 or $300. So I know there's a lot there, but for me, I don't think there's any bet out there right now that is greater value for a horse player than the Stronach 5. I would encourage everybody out there, it's an exercise that you should do. Go back and look at the last 15 times the Stronach 5 has run. Look at the payouts for each race, and then do your own parlay. Sit there and go, look, okay, so, you know, you got a $20 horse here, you got a $14 horse here, you got 8, 8, and 9. You go, well, geez, if you do the quick parlay, you know, geez, this thing should pay no more than $3,800 or $4,000. Well, look it, you paid 19 G's. You're like, man, oh man, I got to get involved in that. And unfortunately for me, full disclosure, I was 4 or 5 that day. I was really sour that I didn't hit it, and I was even more pissed off that I didn't hit it because of how much it paid. I'm like, God, how did I miss this? So, you know, I'll be getting my feet wet real soon, the next couple of Fridays, that's for sure.
I'll just second that emotion. Jonathan and I have talked about this on the show and off air. He, too, had 4 or 5 last week, and I think he missed one of the cheap ones. He had the big prices. He faded a $9 winner, and it cost him the 15. But mm-hmm. We've noticed that bet overperforms. There's a lot of reasons why I think that is, but the important thing is that it should be on players' radars. We're going to be doing a lot more, I think, in 2020 with the Stronach 5, and Eddie, you know, no good deed goes unpunished around here. We might have to have you on to handicap one of those with us.
I would love to. I do. I love that bet. And look, I follow Golden Gate because that seems to be a play. Now we got Santa Anita coming back. I'm sure Santa Anita will be involved as well. And, you know, but like, you know, sometimes you just, you know, like I said, as a handicapper, you just got to do a little bit of homework. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with, you know, look at, you can hit a track. Like for me and my philosophy on that is like a track that I'm not confident with, or I don't know, I'm not afraid to just say, look, I'm going to spread here. I'm going to go with some good trainers. I'm going to go with horses that are proven. You know, I'm going to look out at some workout reports. And, you know, in other tracks that I know I have confidence in, well, that's where I'll thin out. And then the other ones, maybe I'll spread a little bit, because sometimes you just may get that, you know, that $25 or $30 horse and you get lucky.
I promise I'm going to let you get out of here eventually, but I do want to ask one more handicapping question. It's a two-parter. Sure. I want to hear about what you perceive is your best strength and your greatest weakness as a horse player.
My greatest strength is having courage and standing up and saying, you know what, I like this horse and I don't care what his odds are. I've learned that there has been, honesty, full disclosure, there's probably been, it's happened 10 times too many where I've liked 25 or 40 or 50 to one horses and I'm going, I can't, there's nobody likes this horse. I'm not going to bet him and he wins or she wins. I think that's my greatest strength. I've done that on national television. If you remember, oh boy, I should remember this. I probably go back. It's got to be maybe the 15 Acorn on Belmont Day. I got on television for NBC, and I got up there, and right before I come on, and they knew who I liked, and I'm looking, I'm going, the horse, I say on TV, I go, folks, I can't believe, but the horse that I like is the longest shot on the board, and it was By the Moon. Samantha Siegel, the owner, and By the Moon was a turn back, like Belmont, was 33-1, and I'm on national television, and I'm going, you know what, I'm putting my plums on the table, and I'm going, look, I like this horse, I don't care what the odds are, I don't care what the true handicappers or the track or the public says, I'm going, look, I'm going down, and full disclosure, I bet a $500 daily double By the Moon, and I'm drawing a blank right now. What was that great filly, turf filly, that Mark Cassie had a couple of years ago?
Teppan.
Teppan ran in the next race. And I bet a $500 double with By the Moon at 33-1 on top of Teppan, who I believe went off at 9-2 that day. And the double was coming back like $690. And By the Moon breaks, sits third. I forget what Ortiz was on the horse. The rail was not great. Turning for home, I remember Larry Colma saying, and By the Moon takes the lead at 33-1. And I'm like, she's going to win it. She's going to win it. And at the eighth pole, for some reason, I forget which Ortiz, so I'm going to blame one of them, is in the three path, and he drifts down to the rail, and I'm saying, I'm with Bob Neumeier, my great friend and former colleague at NBC. I'm going, no, get off the rail. Do not go to the rail. And he goes to the rail, and here comes Todd Pletcher and Johnny V. I forget which horse won it.
Carolina.
Yeah, that's right, Carolina. And watch the replay. Carolina gets left at the gate, too. And I'm like, how in the hell do I lose this photo? And sure enough, Ortiz goes to the rail. Here comes Carolina on the highway. Johnny V, he beats me. I get beat a jump at 33-1. Of course, Teppan wins, of course. And I'm just like, are you really serious? Are you really going to beat me by going to the worst part of the racetrack? And sure enough, she did, he did, and it cost me, just do the math, it cost me probably about $200,000. I mean, it was one of those where, look at, again, I know I'm going off here a little bit.
But, I love, you know, it.
Like, for me, that's my greatest strength, is if I like a horse, I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. I don't care if I'm doing it on TV or I'm sitting in my living room on my ExpressBet account and I'm firing. Like, if I like a horse, I've learned that. So I think that's my greatest strength. My weakness is sometimes I think I know it all. I think I should take the advice of that city I traveled through one time in Texas. Sometimes you have to El Paso. And I still need to learn that. That, you know what,
too loose.
This is not the race that you want to get involved in. Yeah. And you just need to stop in El Paso and have a beverage and live to fight another day. So I think I've learned better at, you know, I like a horse in every race that I look at. I don't care if it's Mountaineer or Belterra or Santa Anita, Gulfstream, Saratoga. But I think I still need to improve on looking at a race and going, you know what, I'm going to stop in that town in Texas and I'm just going to watch and observe.
Great stuff, Eddie. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. We're going to put in one more plug for the book, Eddie Olchek, Beating the Odds in Hockey and in Life. Great stuff about racing. Great stuff about hockey. Great stuff about living a better life, we're going to go ahead and say. Get this one, folks, for yourself, for a holiday gift, on sale now. What's the best way, Eddie, for people to pick up a copy?
You can go to your local bookstore, Barnes & Noble, or, of course, the world that we live in now. And my wife, Diana Olchek, I don't know if this is good or bad, but she was Shopper of the Month at Amazon.com last month. So,
fantastic.
Hey, can we edit that? I've been married 31 and a half years. Look, if you're going to be mad at me anyways, you know what? Screw it. Just leave it on. You don't have to edit that out. So.
I'm leaving it in. You convinced me.
You could go to Amazon. It's doing very well. It's obviously doing very well in sports books, which is great, and hockey books, obviously, but it's doing very well in cancer books as well, and I'm very proud of that. So I hope people will enjoy it. And you know, people ask me, "You're going to write another book?" I'm going, you know what? I think the next book I would like to just write, maybe the life and times of hockey and horse racing stories by Eddie Olchek. Just short, quick little anecdotes, you know, like a podcast version in a book form, and just tell stories at the track or inside the locker room. And, you know, maybe I will. I don't know. But if some of my former friends, and I say that in bold letters, former friends, they asked if there are any crayons with this book. And I'm like, you know what? You guys, you're out of the will.
That's just mean. So, oh, that's great.
But I always appreciate you having me on, Pete. Continued success. I'm a big fan. And I look forward to chatting with you again really soon. And looking forward to the Pegasus. I'm hoping to play in the tournament this year. And then, look, we're not that far away from the first Saturday in May. So I've already made my travel arrangements. And looking forward to the road to the Triple Crown. So Merry Christmas. Happy holidays to you and all your listeners. And I look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you, my friend. You and Perry Lefko did a fantastic job just as I'm paging through here. And if you want to workshop the new idea, come on here, tell hockey and horse racing stories, Handicap Astronic 5. The door is always open, my friend. Eddie Olchek, thank you so much for your time.
Anytime. Thanks.
And now I'd like to welcome back for her final appearance for the year 2019 on this show, our frequent guest and friend from the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. It's Kim Weir. Kim, Merry Christmas.
Well, indeed. Happy holidays. I'm sitting in a snow globe here in Saratoga by the fireplace. Delighted to chat with you and the gang.
Oh, fantastic. We've just got a bunch of rain here in New York. This has been the worst stretch of December weather in New York City. No snow, maybe a couple of flakes. They turn to water when they hit the ground and just gray. I actually envy you being up there in Saratoga, though. I am glad I don't have to shovel.
Yeah. Well, today it's one of those, like, I don't even know if we really will have to shovel. It just keeps snowing, but it's sort of a sugar coating. So it's the best kind. It keeps you inside. It's just enough to keep you inside, but not enough to make you have to work very hard.
That's great. Well, as we approach the end of the year, there were a few things I wanted to talk about. First of all, on balance, how is our partnership going? How are we as horse players doing in this fight to find homes for retired racehorses?
Well, I would say you all have hit the board in a big way. Cannot say how much we appreciate what the horse players have done in 2019. This has been an awesome, awesome partnership. 73 individual horse players have given through the In the Money Players podcast link. We are covering the costs. Us collectively, almost six horses in our herd have been fed, cared for, good feet, care and veterinary over the course of the year. So I don't know where, you know, you and I had this glimmer in our eye, Pete, a year ago, where we thought we'd be, but I am quite sure we are far, far past that that goal. It's just been awesome. It's awesome. The horses are clearly in the heart of the horse player. 100% sure.
That's great. Now, that said, there's still work to be done here. That's the thing with racehorses. There's more coming off the track every day, and I'm glad we have done well this year, but I want to keep the good momentum going and see if we can't up that number in our personal herd a little bit higher. A couple of interesting ways to do that here as we approach the end of the year. I did get an email the other day from you about end of year giving with an eye towards some tax benefits that players can certainly get. Hey, maybe you hit that mandatory pick six at Aqueduct the other day. Maybe you've got an influx of cash. You're looking to do some giving. Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation is a very worthy place to put some of that money. Can you sum up the contents of that email for the listeners who might not have seen it, Kim?
Sure, I'd be happy to. And this is just, you know, the good thing about your audience is you're a very financially oriented group, and you think about what's the smart way to do anything, place a bet or manage donations for end of year tax advantages. So the two things that I wanted to share with our donor base generally and friends of the TRF herd were two things that are somewhat less well known, but are pretty incredibly impactful for folks like us. And they are the donation of an appreciated stock or mutual fund. So basically the donation of an appreciated asset that you bought at one price and it is now increased in value. That's the first option. So talk about that. And the second is a qualified charitable distribution. Both of these things enable an individual to give to any charity of their choice the full value of an invested asset without any capital gains, without paying the tax on the appreciation, and neither do we. So to be specific, the donation of an appreciated stock or mutual fund is essentially saying, you know, I got my AOL stock as a founder. Here we are all these years later. It's increased in value. I'm going to give 10 shares to the TRF. Those would be leaving your portfolio and have no capital gains, but they'd arrive and be immediately converted to cash for us, and we also would not pay any taxes on them. So the full value converts to the charity. Definitely not trying to go into a financial advisor role here on your show. I have this email, which has a link to all the details of how this works, but it is essentially calling your broker and saying, hey, I've got 10 shares that have appreciated. Let's transfer them to Charity X, perhaps TRF. And it is a simple and one of the easiest ways to give a charity that it's not a tax credit in any way. It is a minimizing of future taxes that you might pay when you were to sell that asset. So anyway, it's just like one of the greatest ways to give if you have such things, because you actually aren't writing any checks out of your liquid assets.
That's right.
So there's that. The second thing, the qualified charitable distribution is a very specific thing for an audience of a particular age. So that would be an age of 70.5 years. Anyone with a pre-tax retirement account has eligibility to make this kind of a tax-free donation in the same way where you're just moving something out of that retirement account directly into our brokerage account and not having any tax implications of doing that. So it's similar, except that it's coming out of a pre-tax retirement account instead of just being an asset. Both of these things are the kind of ways you can give without ever actually stroking a check or hitting your checking account. And once again, minimizing some tax exposure. They're not tax credits, they're not tax benefits, but they are tax advantageous. So I have this handy dandy email with links to expert articles about that. If anyone wants to receive that, they can certainly reach out to me and I'll send it along just for information. My role is to inform. It is not to advise.
Remind folks the best way to reach out to you. I assume email?
Yeah, email is perfect and it's simple. It's kim@thoroughbredretirement.org. And I'd love to hear from you. So happy to share that information.
I was also very happy to see that you guys are partnering up with one of our partners, our friends at Old Smoke Clothing, to do some TRF t-shirts. Wanted to remind listeners that if you use our promo code MONEY, you can get free shipping. They have free shipping over a certain point anyway, but I believe you can even just get one shirt with the promo code MONEY, and that'll waive the shipping and reduce what you're having to pay there. And obviously we've got our In the Money Media shirts over there, including the new chalk eating weasel design. But Kim, I want you to talk about the designs that you guys have with our friends at Old Smoke.
Oh, yeah. Well, it is such a pleasure to work with those guys. They are just, they so believe in horse racing. Talk about more of the, of those of us whose hearts and souls are invested in this sport and these animals. And so they're just great, great guys. And we are so tickled to have them helping us share our message. And we've, they're a great design team, as you all know. And the two things we've done, we've done two pieces. We've t-shirts and hoodies. One is kind of a retro looking thoroughbred retirement logo. It's kind of got that, I don't know, the Abercrombie and Fitch or like established date 1983, with our horse and our tree, in script. It's a neat sort of a, again, kind of got that retro old school, look, identity brand. But much fresher than probably buying it. My husband said this, he said, "Have you ever seen me wear a t-shirt with a website on it?" And the answer is a firm, emphatic no. So the Old Smoke t-shirts are charity promoting t-shirts that even my husband will wear.
That's great. How
I would. But the second brand, or your logo that they've done for us, design, I guess that's the right word, is yeah, they're both my favorite, but this one's more my favorite because it's taking our tagline, our saving horses, saving lives, and putting that out there. And it's much like in the Old Smoke way of an insider's hint that if you know, it doesn't say TRF, it doesn't say Thoroughbred Retirement, it certainly doesn't have our website on it. It just has our horse and our tree, our symbolic, iconic, I hope, logo, and saving horses, saving lives. It's the kind of thing that you wear and somebody's like, huh, tell me about that. That's what I want. That's the one I want all of your listeners to buy.
That's awesome.
Because there's a hoodie and there's a t-shirt. And I, of course, have already loaded up. I don't think any of my family members are going to listen today, but I have loaded up. Everybody's getting Old Smoke gear under the Christmas tree. And I just love the idea that you wear something like this and people then go lean in and go, huh, tell me about that. What is that? And boy, the ability to have Old Smoke's quality of products and just coolness of look, carrying the message of our horses, just makes me so happy. And then as the good guys that they are, and kind of like I use it as the Tom's model, they are making a 10% a proceeds donation to our horses. We'll do that on a quarterly basis, so the dollars will go straight to Old Smoke, but then they will donate. And so not only are you carrying the message on a cool tee or hoodie, but you are also giving to the horses through their great generosity. So it's a fabulous partnership. We talk about a win-win, and plus it's a great shopping opportunity for all of us who may be in need of such things at this time of year.
I'll put in a plug for the quality of the shirt that you were mentioning. They are the softest t-shirts I own, and the stuff is great quality. I'll be ordering an Old Smoke one myself. Before I let you get out of here, I just wanted one more update. We did the annual update. We also talked a bunch. I did a little special spot for you guys around Giving Tuesday. And I was curious to know how Giving Tuesday worked out for the TRF.
Oh my gosh. Well, it was, talk about a shot in the arm for a hardworking team. All of us at the TRF, I speak for the whole dedicated bunch, but we set that goal that which you communicated to your audience so effectively, that we had set a goal of $10,000, which was to fill the farrier fund for all of our horses' hooves for 1 month. And talk about a testament to the spirit that is moving throughout the horse players and throughout the industry to take care of these animals. We watched and as the wave was building throughout the day, and we cleared 16,000 that night by midnight. And the thing is, the dollars continue to roll in for the Giving Tuesday. We don't promote it anymore, but when folks pledge or they send checks, we are on the cusp of hitting the $20,000 mark with that Giving Tuesday, which is just totally amazing. We are so thrilled. It's sort of over north of 200 individual gifts. I think about 25% of those were brand new first-time donors. Just wonderful, wonderful things that we just couldn't have asked for any more, and are so grateful. And the horses say thank you. They just can't do that themselves, so I get to do that for them. Their hooves are their most important asset. No hoof, no horse is our slogan, and that's been true since the days of Aristotle. So thank you for all that you did, Pete, and for every single one of your listeners who joined the cause. And together we did something great on Giving Tuesday. Many, many thanks.
I give out the URL to donate many times on these airwaves. I'll do it once more here live with you, trfinc.org/players. We'd love to get a couple more donations before the year is out to make sure to support the fantastic work that Kim and her colleagues are doing. Unscheduled question. The horse logo that you described, is that based on a particular horse that you know of?
Oh, that is a great question. And I simply don't know.
I want to say quick call, but I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it really could be. I mean, the truth is who it should be would be Promise Road. Promise Road was the very first horse that came off the van at Wallkill. And so he undoubtedly found himself in a pasture under a tree. And so while I cannot say with the certainty that this was designed after him, I think we can all go into the holidays thinking when you see that logo, he was our first horse. So that is who he symbolically is represented by in our logo. Promised Road, a very fitting name for the first horse to pave the way for so many thousands after him.
That's where it all started. It continues today. Kim, we're going to have you on early next year. We've got some plans as we finish up our first year of official partnership and hopefully look forward to doing more stuff. I never did get out to do one of the farm tours with you. We're going to do that for sure. Want to record some audio about it. We want to make a big push and continue to prove that horse players really do have the horses in their hearts, as you've reminded us so often this year. Kim Weir, thank you so much for your appearance today and all that you do for the horses.
It is such a pleasure, Pete. Thank you. Thank you. Happy holidays to all.
That's going to do it for today's edition of the show. We'd like to thank Eddie Olchek and Kim Weir. Also, we will thank our sponsors, 10 Strike Racing, Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, Stats Race Lens, among them most of all. Want to thank all of you, the listeners. We got a few more shows left in the year 2019, but it's been a very successful year, and your support is the reason why, and we appreciate it. This show's been a production of In the Money Media. In the Money Media's business manager is Drew Cotney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos.